You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good morning. My name's Stephen Pfeiffer. I'm a senior fellow here at the Brookings Center on 21st Century Security and Intelligence. And it's my pleasure to moderate today's panel discussion on dealing with Iran and the Iranians. Western concerns about Iran's nuclear ambitions go back about two decades. And although Iran claims the right under the Non-Proliferation Treaty to civil nuclear activities and civil nuclear technologies, including enrichment for non-weapons purposes, there are concerns about where Iran is going. And in fact, Iran's continued actions in enrichment contravene UN Security Council resolutions, which have called for Iran to suspend those activities. Now, Iran's actions over the last 15 years have provoked a number of questions about how far it wants to go in the nuclear field. And this includes questions such as, Iran did not disclose its enrichment centers until they were revealed by others. Iran has an enrichment program that appears to be inconsistent with one nuclear reactor at Bushehr, particularly when Iran has a contract with Russia whereby Russia has agreed to provide enriched fuel for that reactor. There are also questions about Iran's continuing efforts to develop ballistic missiles, which is the preferred weapon for delivery of a nuclear weapon. And finally, there are questions about Iranian work in weaponization of nuclear material and Iran's failure to work with the International Atomic Energy Agency to explain these activities. The assessment of the U.S. intelligence community has been that Iran has not made a decision to acquire a nuclear weapon, but that it seeks to be in position so that with its enrichment activities and other capabilities, that it could move very quickly to do so if and when it did make that decision. Now, the European Union III, which has been the European Union plus Germany, France, and Britain, began a dialogue with Iran already back in 2004 to try to dissuade Iran from some of the more worrisome nuclear activities. That process evolved. By 2009, you had China, Russia, and the United States involved. It's now referred to as the EU 3 plus 3 or the P5 plus 1, depending on whether you look at it from a European Union angle or a UN angle. But there's been a dialogue going on for about 9 years in fits and starts. Over the last several years, you've seen growing sanctions on Iran. In 2010, the UN Security Council approved a resolution which, among other things, applies an arms embargo on Iran. And since then, the West and other countries have applied additional financial and economic sanctions on Tehran. Now, the last round of negotiations took place in Almaty in February 26 to 27, and the reports afterwards seem to suggest some degree of cautious optimism by both sides. Last month, experts met in Turkey, and the negotiations in Almaty will resume on Friday and Saturday when the EU plus 3 or the P5 plus 1 will come together with the Iranian negotiators. So as we look towards that, we're delighted here in this panel today to talk about, you know, what works in dealing with Iran, how best to negotiate with them, what does not work. And we're delighted that we have Javier Solana and Gary Seymour here to help us shed some light on these questions. Just a very brief introduction. Javier Solana is a distinguished fellow here at the Brookings Institution, but before that, very long and distinguished diplomatic career, including the Spanish foreign minister, NATO secretary general, and the European Union's High Representative for Common and Foreign and Security Policy. And it was in that capacity that from 2004 until 2009, he led the EU effort, the negotiating effort with Iran. Gary Seymour is Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center at Harvard. But from 2009 up until early this year, he was a Special Assistant to the President and the White House Coordinator for Weapons of Mass Destruction, which meant he was both at the center of American policy on Iran but also had opportunities to sit across the table from Iranian negotiators. So we'll have opening comments from our two panelists and then open the floor to questions. Javier, do you want to start us off?
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to participate in this debate. As has been said, I was in charge of the negotiation for a long period of time until 2009, from 2003, when I was the first visitor to Tehran with the plan in that, time, a plan of the European Union. So from 2010 to today, I have been less in charge of, although I follow very closely and I maintain some lines of communication with Tehran. I don't have any responsibility from there on. Let me start a little bit reminded how this started, because I think it's very important to have a perspective of how the whole process has gone. What to my mind has been the most important moments in which movement from Iran may have taken place, why it wasn't happened, and at the last moment I will say how I see the next steps that to my mind could be taken in order to put the process in shape with many difficulties that we have in front of us. But let me start by 2003. 2003 was the first time that three foreign ministers from the European Union and myself went to Tehran. And we signed an important agreement at the time. At that time was Khatami, still the president, and our interlocutor was Rouhani, that disappeared from the picture immediately. But it was important that we signed what we call the Tehran Agreement, that it had two points, basically. Tehran will stop, would not start. At that time, we had to stop very little. Their capabilities, the moves in their capabilities, and we will give Tehran the facilities for whatever they wanted in peaceful use of nuclear energy and also on economic help. The commitment also of Tehran was to sign something very important, which was the additional protocol attached to the non-proliferation treaty. That went for a year, and everything went okay, but at the elections the general elections after Khatami, when Ahmadinejad arrived to power, it was a big change. They denounced the Tehran Agreement. And they denounced the Tehran Agreement. They didn't sign at the end the additional protocol, and the whole thing would not succeed. Now, then Ahmadinejad arrived to power, and it was a year and a half, without much of a contact. Then we had with Ahmadinejad, with the Supreme Leader, and he appointed somebody with whom we did most of the negotiation, which is the actual president of the parliament in Iran, called Ali Larijani. Is somebody which you can talk to him well, you can get engaged. For me, it was a difficult part of the negotiation, but to a certain extent, a rational part of the negotiation. Now, to make the long story short, I will tell you that it started from you have to suspend, and we will offer you something. We ended up with that being impossible. They did not suspend. Any right that they had through the non-proliferation treaty will be maintained. They will be against their dignity. And remember two words which are very important when we negotiate with Iran. One is the word aberu in Persian, which is dignity. In a way, it has other significance, but the most important significance is dignity. And the other is malahat, which is self-interest. And you have to find an agreement between dignity and self-interest. And those two words, you just listen to them over and over again. And the question that have not been able is to find an equilibrium between these two concepts. Whenever they ask for dignity, we could not give it. And they ask today, they are accepting something against their self-interest, like sanctions. Since we don't give enough dignity, they will be ready to accept this. Is something against their will. So keep that in mind, because we will come again to talk about that. Now, the two most important moments, and I said two of those, I'll say two, is when we offer a new proposal, which is freeze for freeze. You stop your centrifuge at the level you have at the day of the agreement, and we will not take the sanctions out, but will maintain the level of sanctions at the same level. That was an interesting proposal, that it was understood by Larijani at the beginning. But at the end, as you know, that failed. It failed why? Because they didn't want to take a position that stopping to assemble centrifuge was giving up a right, and they were not ready to give up any right. So then we continue with that, and presented in Tehran a more formalized freeze-for-freeze program, and together with another carrot from energy, from other cooperation with Iran in other fields, And the most important thing is that proposal that I took with me was signed by everybody. For the first time was signed by Condoleezza Rice. The ministers from the European Union always signed the letters, but this very letter was signed by Condoleezza Rice also. And that was really a certain shock for them, that the Americans got into the picture in a much more clear manner with the signature of the Secretary of State. We thought that that would give some oxygen to the process, but as you know, that was a failure. President Putin went to see the Supreme Leader taking this support in my proposal. And as you know, the result of all that was a failure, not only a failure on the proposal, but a failure that Larry Gianni, the negotiator, was forced out of his position. So we were without solution and without negotiator. So pretty bad moment with all the effort that we have done. Then they appoint a new negotiator, which is Jalili, which is the actual negotiator still, which doesn't have, to my mind, the capacity of a negotiator. He's just somebody who tells you what he has received the morning before he goes to the meeting, but he doesn't have the flexibility of going into a real negotiation. So there we went until Geneva. 2009 was a very important meeting for the first time in the accompaniment in the negotiation, one American, physically. And that was Bill Burns, the Undersecretary of State today. And that was a very good meeting. In the atmosphere, I provided for a meeting, a bilateral meeting between Jalili and Bill Burns, that it wasn't bad. We thought we had agreed on the swap of enriched uranium to 20%, take it out and enrich it outside the country. But at the end of the day, and then Gary will say much more information about that, because the continuation of that, I was already out of the position. It was a failure. But I do think that at that time, it was the moment in which I have seen a closer possibility of an agreement. And I think if you analyze properly that period of time, even in Tehran, was the sentiment that there was possibly to get an agreement. We agreed formally, but at referendum for 48 hours. In those 48 hours, the whole thing was broken. But again, it's been the moment in which we're being close. Now, let me tell you that the problems I see in front of us. I see in front of us several problems. One, a problem of calendars. We have elections in Tehran before the summer. It will be very difficult to get something going before those presidential elections. At the same time, we have pressure from Israel that, we don't know. I don't know exactly how it's been the agreement between Netanyahu and President Obama. But whatever the time which is left will be short. It will not be very, very long. The second big problem that we have is Syria. I don't think it will be possible to move on Tehran without solving Syria. Syria has a relationship with Tehran really, really deep. I heard somebody in Syria tell me our relation with Tehran is deeper, even militarily, than the relation that exists between two members of NATO. So they really have a very intense relationship. And without solving that problem, it would be very difficult to get the negotiation moving. For Tehran, Syria is a very important actor. And for that, we need to get all the pressure possible in Russia. Russia is the player, probably, that can get out of this situation in Syria. But remember, we have two problems which are linked, Tehran and Syria, and we have the P5 together in one, in principle, Iran, and separated in the other, which is Syria. So we have a pretty bad situation. And that is what I think we have in front of us. The other thing that I would like to mention, the third thing I would like to mention, is sanctions. Sanctions have to be reviewed before the end of the summer. And today we have been able to put the tough sanctions on Iran that are hitting their economy, but still with maintaining the price of oil at a level which is supportable. Now, that is because the 4% of the spare oil production that is still exists is there. But imagine that for a moment the economy goes a little bit better, global economy. There are more needs of oil. Still, you know, as you know, Iran is selling gas in particular to China at a very low cost. If the economy grows globally, it will be very difficult to stop the most important thing that we have to stop, that is the Iran does not export any oil at all if they want to make really all the sanctions. And that will come really to China. If China accedes to get not to keep on buying oil and gas from Iran. So we have a really complicated picture in front of us. I think that the Iranians are really concerned. They know that they have going against self-interest as far as the economy is concerned, but still they haven't found a manner which will give them the capacity for them to save their face or to come out of this negotiation with dignity. They keep saying always and always the same. We don't want to be a nuclear power. We want to be recognized as a regional power. And this is the line in which they really continue to say whenever you meet with them and enter into the debate or discussion. I'll stop here. We have many, many more things to say, but Gary has many more things from the White House that I cannot speak in behalf of.
Gary.
Thank you, Javier. Well, Javier, I think, has done a very good job of describing the ups and downs, the frustrations and the difficulties of trying to negotiate a nuclear deal with Iran over the past decade. And my expectation is that those ups and downs and difficulties and frustrations are going to continue for the foreseeable future. Why? First of all, there's just a fundamental difference among the parties on what the objective of these negotiations are. From the standpoint of the United States, working through the P5+1, we're trying to limit Iran's capacity to produce nuclear weapons by physically limiting their ability to produce fissile material and by increasing means of monitoring their nuclear program so that we can detect future efforts to cheat and build secret facilities. That's our objective. From Iran's standpoint, the objective is exactly the opposite. They want to create the capacity to produce nuclear weapons, which means having an unrestricted program to produce enriched uranium with as little monitoring as possible, whatever is required by the NPT. So both sides have a very different view and national interest in terms of what we're trying to achieve. Secondly, there's a fundamental disconnect in terms of the what I would call the legal framework that the P5+1 and Iran approach these negotiations. From the standpoint of the P5+1, the onus is on Iran to demonstrate that its program is peaceful by complying with the various UN Security Council resolutions and IAEA resolutions that call on Iran to do certain things, including suspension of some parts of their nuclear program, cooperate with the IAEA, and so forth. From Iran's standpoint, these UN Security Council and IAEA acts are not considered legitimate. From Iran's standpoint, they are not required to comply with any of these resolutions. They should be treated like any other NPT party in terms of enjoying an extensive civil nuclear program under IAEA safeguards. So from a legal perspective, the two sides are approaching this negotiation from a very different standpoint. Given these fundamental differences in interest and perspective, the theory of the P5+1 has been to try to at least get agreement on some modest measures that would limit Iran's nuclear program in some ways in exchange for limiting sanctions, and in the hope that that would create confidence and create a context that would make it possible to try to negotiate a more comprehensive agreement, at the same time slow down the nuclear program. But even in this very modest area, the two sides are very far apart in terms of the quid pro quo. Both sides accept the basic concept that we're talking about limits on the nuclear program in exchange for limits on sanctions, but when you get down to the details, they're very far apart. the P5 plus one are asking for pretty substantial actions on the part of Iran in terms of limiting their nuclear program, shutting down GOM, stopping production of 20%, shipping out a large portion of the 20% stockpile that Iran currently has, and, you know, in exchange for some modest but concrete sanctions relief. In exchange, the Iranians are demanding total lifting of all sanctions in exchange for stopping a production of 20%, something that they could reverse overnight. So even in terms of the quid pro quo for a sort of modest step, there's a long way to go before the two sides could come to an agreement. So I don't expect there to be an agreement, certainly before the presidential elections in Iran in June. Nonetheless, I think both sides have an interest in keeping this process alive, so I would expect the talks to continue. And there may be some, you know, incremental progress in terms of a slight narrowing of these big differences among the parties, but I don't think it will come to an agreement. At the same time, I think even if there isn't a formal deal, I do think the Iranians are exercising some constraints on the program for political reasons, mainly because, in my view, the Supreme Leader is focusing right now on managing the presidential elections and does not want to have to deal with a foreign policy crisis. So, for example, the Iranians are deliberately converting enough of their 20% enriched uranium to oxide form in order to stay below the red line that Prime Minister Netanyahu identified last September at the UN. So for the time being, it appears as though the Iranians, for political reasons, are deliberately slowing down those parts of the program that they fear could trigger either more sanctions or even a military strike. Now, that may change after the presidential elections, but for now, there seem to be some limits on the program. For the future, I think the most important question is whether or not it's possible to increase the current level of sanctions by cutting even further the market that Iran enjoys in terms of its oil exports. And that's a real question. I mean, up to now, the sanctions have been remarkably successful in terms of limiting Iran's oil exports because there's been alternative sources of oil. And so Iran's main customers, China, India, Japan, Korea, have been willing to cut back. And that has had a substantial impact. Whether that can continue in the future is very uncertain. It will depend upon the global a balance of a supply and demand for oil. It will depend on economic activity, whether there's an economic recovery and what impact that has on oil. But that question of Iran's oil exports, that's their greatest concern. And if it's possible for additional cuts to be made, I think it makes it much more likely that there can at least be an interim agreement that would limit further sanctions in exchange for some limits on the nuclear program and potentially create a basis for trying to negotiate a comprehensive agreement. Even if that negotiation fails, it still creates some breathing room in terms of limiting the program and slowing down the nuclear clock and making a military attack less necessary. I'll stop there.
Great. Thank you, Senator Gary. Let me put one question to both of you. There have been times where I think, Javier, you referred to 2009, where the Iranians did agree to basically transfer out their stockpile of HU, that it, or enriched uranium that had been enriched to 20%, in return for then getting fuel for their research reactor. But the Iranians walked back from that deal within a couple of days. So it appears that within Tehran there are differences in how to engage this question. How does that show up at the negotiating table? Are these visible there? Or
yes. Okay, that 2009 was important for many reasons. Remember, in September 2009, it was discovered another facility for enriching uranium, which was not known. They have not declared to the agency. And the international, well, the P5 plus the Europeans, found through intelligence that was going on. We had information about that before September, but it was made public at the midst of the General Assembly of 2009. And that was a big shock for Iran. to really, after having made the speech, Marina Yanez in the General Assembly, saying that they were peaceful, etc., etc., it was discovered that it was made public that they had another facility that had been had not been declared. And that led Iran, with some of his friends, let's say, frustrated with that, discovery. Now, that's the first thing. The second thing is that for the first time, Obama was already in power, and for the first time, the United States allowed an American to be at the table. And as I said before, with Bill Burns, and we arranged for him to have a bilateral talk in Geneva. The meeting was in Geneva. And it was very well, as I said, the climate was very, very good, and we agreed of something very important for Iran, because Iran at that time was running out of fuel at 20% to put it into the reactor which creates isotope for medicine. Historically, Argentina had been the country that were putting the G20, the enriched uranium into the the reactor to produce isotopes. And there was a difficult moment for them. And we accepted to be ourselves who put that, but we had to get out of the country the same amount that we put in. Okay? One enriched, and the other, we put the enriched, and we had to take the outer out. And so there were two elements that were leading towards facilitation in the relation. But as you know, and I said, we had a good meeting. We had press conference separated, myself and Jalili, with an agreement that we will not contradict each other. And that was okay. It was perfectly done. And we thought, at least I thought, that we celebrated, really. Gary knows what happened the day after, the 2 days after, big battle inside Tehran. Big battle inside Tehran, and well, the supreme leader at the end didn't accept the deal. And that was the end. For me, that was the end. I finished there with that frustration. I had maintained with Larijani some talks and some. Larijani is not the best friend of Jalili, as you can imagine. Larijani is now running for president. He's an important figure. Let's see how he behaves if he is elected president. But at the end of the day, the supreme leader is the one who has the... And one of the big problems with negotiating with a country which has a structure of power so difficult, religious, civilian, etc., is who is the interlocutor. You have we have our system of naming interlocutors, but at the other side, you may not match the interlocutor with the other interlocutor. So this is another added complication for the negotiation, to my mind.
Yeah. Gary?
Well, I agree with that. I mean, the decision-making process inside Tehran is very obscure, and I think it probably makes it much more complicated in terms of trying to reach an agreement, especially because because the political competition among the various figures in Iran becomes intertwined with the nuclear negotiations. And so certainly the 2009 episode was a good example where President Ahmadinejad was clearly in favor of the deal, and I think to some extent the opponents were motivated, aside from the merits of the agreement, they were motivated, by a desire to try to prevent him from taking credit for making progress. But the collapse of the 2009 deal, I think, was a critical turning point, at least in terms of what the administration's perceptions were. It demonstrated how difficult it would be to get even a very modest agreement, and this was an extremely modest agreement, and shifted the president's policy to one that emphasized increasing pressure as a way to gain leverage and purchase. And, of course, we then embarked on a very difficult six-month negotiation for another UN Security Council resolution. And at the very last moment, as most of you will remember, Brazil and Turkey and Iran announced, an agreement, which was viewed in the White House really as a pretty transparent effort to try to delay the sanctions. So we went ahead with those sanctions. And since then, we and the Iranians have been locked in this sort of spiral where we keep increasing sanctions as the negotiations make no progress. They keep going ahead with their nuclear program, and both sides are trying to build up bargaining leverage. We haven't reached the point yet where some kind of an agreement that would, you know, relax the sanctions and the nuclear activities, you know, is possible.
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and open the floor to questions. If I could ask, please wait for a microphone to arrive, and if you could state your name and affiliation. Let's start right here.
My name is Chi Dong Lee. I'm a Washington correspondent for South Korea's Yonhap News Agency. Good to see you here. I got a question for Mr. Gary Seymour. Actually, today the Washington Post reported about speculation on nuclear ties between Iran and North Korea. What is your assessment of the problem? And also, I'm sorry, but let me ask you about North Korea nuclear test last month. The Washington Post also questions whether it was a plutonium or uranium-based nuclear test. What is your opinion about that also? Thank you.
Well, as to what kind of material was used in the test, I don't think we know. The test didn't vent, so there was no way to measure whether it was plutonium, you know, or highly enriched uranium, so it could have been either. In terms of nuclear ties between Iran and North Korea, I'm not aware of any, but it's something I think we have to be concerned about, because we know there's an extensive, certainly extensive cooperation in the missile area, and one could imagine that North Korea could provide substantial assistance to Iran in terms of enrichment. I expect that the North Koreans are, you know, considerably more advanced, you know, than the Iranians are in terms of mastering centrifuge technology, so I think it's something we have to keep a very close eye on. And we know that North Korea in the past has been willing to sell nuclear technology and materials, such as the reactor they were building in Syria.
Okay.
Howard Moreland, private citizen. What is our rationale for threatening war against Iran in order to perpetuate the Israeli monopoly on nuclear weapons in the Middle East, and why is a nuclear weapon-free Middle East not part of the discussion?
Well, it has been. It has been part of a discussion. Remember 2009, in the same General Assembly in which it was made clear the other facility that was secret by Iran. It was the first time that the prime ministers of the different countries of the non-proliferation treaty had a summit. It was the first time in I don't know how many years. And one of the agreements of that summit is to try to work hard in 2 years to get the possibility of beginning a discussion about a free trade zone in the Middle East. As you know, somebody, the Secretary General had to appoint somebody to prepare that summit. It has not taken place. But it was, 2009 was a moment in which motion in that direction was started. I think that will continue, although in 2013 there was to have the second phase. It didn't take place for lack of agreement among the most important players on how to follow. But it's something which is already on the table for the first time. I never imagined that would have been in 2009, but it was. And President Obama put it on the table in the General Assembly, in which, as I said, for the first time, it was a meeting at the highest level of the signatory members of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that was on the agenda.
Yeah, I would just add, I think President Obama has explained in speeches and interviews why he thinks a nuclear-armed Iran is unacceptable from the standpoint of U.S. national interest, the risk that it would lead to further proliferation in the region, the risk that a nuclear-armed Iran would threaten our allies, both Israel and the Saudis and others, the risk that a nuclear-armed Iran might either, on purpose or inadvertently, provide weapons or fissile material to terrorists. So I think the president has in his mind a very, you know, clear basis on which to say, as he has said, that he will use any means necessary, including military force, to stop Iran from having nuclear weapons. The fact that Israel has nuclear weapons is really a separate issue. And, as Javier has said, there is a process to try to achieve progress toward a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East. That obviously is not going to bear fruit anytime soon, especially given current circumstances in the region. But all countries, at least in theory, support, such a nuclear weapons-free zone, including Israel. The question is what kind of conditions would be necessary before you could actually put that in place. And clearly the conditions in the Middle East are not ripe for that now.
Barbara Slavin from the Atlantic Council and AlMonitor.com. Good to see both of you gentlemen back. I have two questions. I'd like your views on both. First, do you think as long as we're talking to the Iranians, we won't be bombing them? So in that sense, talking has value. And also, the Stuxnet virus, which if the New York Times is to be believed, the Obama administration inherited from the Bush administration. Was it a legitimate use of force against Iran? Thank you.
Well, very difficult questions, both. Now, on the virus, I think that, how would I say it? I think that the most important mistake of the virus was to recognize who had done it. I think that for a long time, the virus was there. Nobody knew who was the father or the mother of the virus. And suddenly, I don't know why, for the sake of prestige, that somebody decided to claim that who was the virus, what was the virus, was the company who had put it in, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that goes to the heart of your question, because if legitimacy is, if you are the first who put the virus in cyberspace, you're lost completely. You are the one who recognized that you have attacked already. I think it's a mistake, but anyway. Now, the second thing I would like to say, that, and I'm convinced of this, it may not be everybody convinced, I think that the level of consistency and coherence of the P5 is diminishing. And it's diminishing first because of Syria. Remember that Syria, China, and Russia are not in the same place that the Americans and the Europeans. And that is an important issue. It's not a minor issue because, as I said before, Iran, Syria is a very important, has an important relationship. If in that we are not together, we will not solve, it will be more difficult to solve the two. Now, I'm very concerned that as time goes by, the P5 are getting less concerted action in many issues, not only Syria. I was surprised the other day in South Africa, the level of statement that the BRICS made. For the first time, I thought that the idea of a different pole that wanted to play not only the economy but also the international affairs was very clearly stated. I think, as it said, that for the third in the last question, the question of the level of energy and the price of energy in the markets is going to be very important. And we have an opening after 2014, according to the latest estimate that I have seen, in order to have the spare oil production to be maintained at 4% of the total production. And if the economy, the global economy, grows a bit, the level of the cuts that are to maintain the level of Iran down, it will be very difficult to be maintained without a great spike in price. It's true that part of the equilibrium is being maintained by shale gas, which shale gas has helped very much in order to maintain the volume of gas into the market and maintain the prices down. But if the economy grows, there's a point of equilibrium in which the prices may go very... and that is something that the Chinese don't want, nobody wants. But if for that not to take place, the Chinese will have to stop the volumes of import that they are doing still for Iran, from Iran.
And I would say the primary factor that determines whether or not military force is used is not what's happening around the diplomatic table, it's what's happening on the ground. you could imagine a situation where, you know, the diplomacy continues fitfully without making any progress, but, you know, the Iranians are cautious and careful to avoid taking actions that might trigger, you know, a military strike. And I think that's actually the situation we're in now. The question is whether or not the Supreme Leader continues to exercise caution and whether he, you know, whether or not he accurately anticipates what kind of actions might trigger a strike. Stuxnet, I don't think I'll comment on, but I will say that I think that this is a game where very, very high national security stakes are at play, and both sides are using, you know, all the levers of power they have available to them in order to try to achieve their interests.
Gary, let me follow up on that question, or the first question about negotiation and military action. And I think one of the concerns that has been expressed in the West is that Iran engages in the negotiations, drags out the talks, but as they do that, in fact, they get closer to the capability where they could have a fairly quickly deploy a nuclear capability. Is there some sort of thing that you would want to see coming out of these negotiations this weekend that might be a signal that, okay, there is in fact a decision on the part of Tehran to actually try to find a solution as opposed to use the talks? You know, what would be sort of your minimum takeaway from the Almaty discussions that would say maybe there is, in fact, is an indication that Iran does want to find a solution?
Well, I have such low expectations of what's going to come out of this next round of talks that I think it's, you know, it's a mistake to try to set the bar. I mean, if they agree to another round of meetings, that will be, you know, the process continuing. But I think that it really is unrealistic to expect that there'd be some kind of breakthrough in these talks. Look, both sides are using, you know, the diplomacy for their own purposes. I mean, the Iranians use diplomacy in an effort to try to show that there's progress and therefore no further sanctions are justified. And to the extent that it looks like there's progress, it helps maintain the value of the rial. The U.S. and the P5+1 use diplomacy in order to demonstrate that Iran is being intransigent and unreasonable, and therefore more sanctions are required. And that process is going to continue. I mean, at some point, if this next round of talks don't produce results, the U.S. And the EU will be looking for additional sanctions in order to increase pressure.
Michael Gordon, New York Times. I have a question for Gary. Can you, you mentioned the restraint that Iran is pursuing. Can you address the new centrifuges that they're also pursuing and what the strategic implications are for a breakout scenario in a military sense, and what, also what policy challenges they pose in the sense that can Iran get to a place where they can take action faster than the international community could respond?
Right. It's a very good question, and there are lots of different ways of looking at these scenarios. But basically, there are two ways Iran could produce highly enriched uranium, weapons-grade uranium. One is to use facilities that are under IAEA inspection, and that's the so-called breakout scenario, where they would either deny the inspectors access or they would kick out the inspectors and then, as quickly as possible, produce enough highly enriched uranium, you know, for a nuclear device. Right now, they're probably at least a couple of months away from being able to do that once a decision is made. As they increase capacity, as they put in more centrifuges, more efficient, more powerful centrifuges like this new generation, they might be able to squeeze down that breakout time to a couple of weeks or even less. And in that case, it's at least theoretically possible that they could move and produce enough a highly enriched uranium for a bomb before the international community could act. I think they're still probably a couple of years away from having that kind of capacity because they need to put in a lot more of these more advanced centrifuges in order to do that. The other scenario, which I think is much more plausible, is what we call sneak out, that they would build a secret facility and then produce weapons-grade uranium, taking their time, and then, you know, once they have enough, they would be in a position to confront the world with a fait accompli. We know that that second approach is the one Iran favors, because twice now they've tried to build secret enrichment plants, first Natanz and then Qom. And my guess is that at some point in the future, they will try to build another secret enrichment plant, because that approach, from their standpoint, poses much fewer threats. If they try to break out using a facility that's under safeguards, they run the risk that it would be detected and the U.S. or Israel or others would act against it, would destroy that facility before it could achieve, before it could produce enough weapons-grade uranium. But the point that the question that Michael is raising is the right one, that if we continue for a couple more years with this current pattern, the Iranians can get closer and closer to having a credible breakout capacity, and they'll use that as a threat. They will threaten that unless certain things are done, unless this sanction or that sanction is lifted, they'll be forced to take action, and that will become a more credible threat. But I don't think they're there now. I think they're still too far away from being able to move quickly for that to be a credible threat.
And then the weaponization process, which is not a simple thing to do. One thing is to have reached to 90% or 80%, but then you have to make a bomb. It's not a trivial thing to do it. But there are two processes which are separate. You can continue working on the weaponization and be very advanced in the weaponization, even if you don't have the 90% already achieved. Therefore, it may be a crossing point in which is shorter than we expect the actual use of a bomb.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the only thing I would add is that we probably have greater capacity to detect and prevent the production of weapons-grade material as opposed to detecting and preventing weaponization. It's not to say that it's impossible to detect that, but it's much more difficult because it can be done with a fewer number of people and facilities that are easier to hide.
Yeah. But wouldn't it be fair to say, just on the weaponization question, if the Iranians want to go for a very basic nuclear weapon, the weapon that was used on Hiroshima was never tested.
Right.
But if they want to go and actually develop a more advanced weapon that could be put on a ballistic missile, then it's a much more sophisticated question, and they would probably want to, would it be fair to assume that they would probably want to test before they actually believe that capability existed?
My sense is yes, they have to test. Tests may be done through computer, etc., but I don't think they have the capacity. A country that has already the capacity can test the next level of bombs without doing a real test. But the first, the last example we have is North Korea and Pakistan. They had to do the test. And today, with the level of information that we have and the capacity of intelligence that we have, I think that is impossible not to be detected, mm-hmm. to my mind. I think this is almost impossible not to be detected. The capacity of intelligence, you have the number of satellites looking at Iran, etc. Once you have, it will be very difficult not to be the test not to be detected.
This is another good example, where the Iranians have imposed political constraints on the program. They had a comprehensive weaponization program, which was detected which was revealed, and they stopped it in 2003. At some point in the future, I could easily imagine them starting that program again in hopes that they would be able to achieve a lot of the preparation work necessary for a nuclear test. And I agree that ultimately it's likely that they would conduct a nuclear test in order to demonstrate that they have a credible nuclear capacity.
Okay, question in the back here. Right there.
Yeah. Brian Beery, Washington correspondent for Europolitics. I'm just wondering, with all of the heating up of the rhetoric in North Korea and the military maneuvers, what impact that is going to have on the Iran nuclear talks, the E3+3 process? Will it somehow suck the momentum out of it because North Korea looks to be more of an urgent threat at the moment, or could it have somehow a positive effect?
I don't think it has any impact at all. All of the P5+1 countries are capable of dealing with several different problems at the same time, so I really don't think it's likely to have a big impact. I think, to some extent, Korea is a good example where there's pretty good cooperation, certainly among the U.S. and China and Russia. All of us want to avoid, a military conflict on the peninsula. But that, I don't think that necessarily translates into greater cooperation on Iran.
Okay.
Edward Levine, former Senate staff member. If the supreme leader is the key to getting Iran to agree to sensible negotiations. And if he has a particular concern for Iran's dignity, as the word was used, what thought has been given to enlisting help from some third party whose mere presence would accord some of that dignity to Iran and also create a channel to the supreme leader?
Well, that had been tried with Turkey. Turkey is a country who has played more relevant outside the formal format, the P5 plus one. I have been talking to the Turks a lot, and they have been used. But as you know, the last intent with Brazil, all that it was supposed to be, we considered that it was a little bit of a ploy, that it was not going to succeed, and it was better not to do it. Maybe we were wrong, but at the time that was the position. Turkey then separated very much from the negotiation. Maybe now, with the position that they have taken new with Israel, maybe another moment in which Turkey may be used. But I cannot imagine another country. The supreme leader doesn't talk to leaders which are not Muslims, with one exception. He met with Putin in the moment in 1997, I think it was, when he went to defend the freed for freeze in front of the supreme leader. He was received by the supreme leader together with Larijani. It was a failure. Larijani was thrown out of the negotiation, and Putin could not convince the supreme leader to the freeze for freeze. So I cannot imagine on any other person or United leaders that can have a good relationship with the supreme leader, with the exception of countries which are Muslims. And probably Turkey continues to be the most at hand. Don't forget that Turkey now has difficulties also for their position in Syria. Turkey is a country which is against the regime in Syria, which is Iran is the big supporter. So it's difficult to find a perfect new interlocutor. I think the best is to maintain with the ones we have. And to my mind, precipitate as much as possible some bilateral contact between the United States and Iran. They have been without contact for a long period of time. It's very difficult to negotiate without a warming up process of bilateral talks. That is my position.
But, you know, of course, we can't really psychoanalyze the supreme leader.
Not right.
But in my view, I think dignity is less important a factor than, A, he wants to have a nuclear weapons capacity, and B, I think he views the nuclear issue as part of a broader struggle with the United States. I mean, he believes that the United States is trying to destroy the Islamic Republic, and we're using the nuclear issue in order to try to achieve that through political and economic pressure. And the irony is that because, in my view, the supreme leader has obstructed the negotiations, he has, in fact, created a self-fulfilling prophecy. We are, in fact, seeking economic sanctions which could potentially pose a threat to the survival of the regime if there's enough public unhappiness with the economic damage that the supreme leader has brought upon his own country and also through their mismanagement.
Hi, thanks. Lara Jakes with Associated Press. Javier, you've spoken a lot this morning about how Syria and the P5 negotiations are intertwined. I'm wondering what effect U.S. military intervention in Syria might have on some of the negotiations, not only recognizing that this would likely be viewed as hostile by Tehran, but also the effect that it would amount to a proxy war with Russia. The Chinese would likely follow the Russian lead. So if you could talk a bit about that, I would appreciate it. Thank you. And Gary, if you'd like to chime in, I'd be interested. Thank you.
I cannot speak with knowledge. I'm not in office. The only information I have is information that I used to have and information that I have through friends which are engaged in the... I think that the United States has not taken a more active role in Syria from the beginning because they didn't want to disturb the possibility of, to give them a space to negotiate with Iran. They probably knew that getting very engaged against Assad, engaged even militarily, could contribute to a breaking in the potential negotiation with Tehran. Nowadays, the situation is a little bit different because the situation within Syria is much worse than what it was at the beginning. I happened to meet yesterday by coincidence in the train coming from New York, the president of the Red Crescent of Syria that was coming from New York, talking to the Secretary General and coming here to inform. And he was telling me that the situation is really catastrophic from all points of view. He told me also that he didn't think that the chemical bombs were moved or were. That's what he told me. I asked him directly if he had it. They have a very good network in the country. But the situation on Syria, I think, is much worse and probably closer to the end. Now, how big the push has to be done, how much the Russians. Now, let me be very... I think we have not played the Russian card sufficiently tough. Remember that Russia, when they put the veto on Syria, they justified for the excessive use on the sanctions on Libya, or the military action on Libya. You remember that. But also they said that they had topics to be discussed bilaterally with the United States. One of them was missile defense. And missile defense had been almost resolved, with the fourth phase being thrown forward into the how many years, I don't know. So that has not been played sufficiently strong, I think, with Russia. I think with Russia we need to be much more engaged in order to resolve the Syrian question and at the end the question of Tehran. That is a concern that I have. I was in Moscow the week before this one, no, the 2 weeks before this one, and I met with Putin, I met with Medvedev, and I see a sentiment which is not better. It's not better vis-à-vis the relationship with the United States, Syria, etc. And my fear is that it may get colder or cooler with the relation to Tehran also. And we may break an agreement that the P5 has been maintained. The P5 has been a miracle, really. The money which has been maintained for such a long period of time in agreement. Now, the moment of sanction, it was overcome. We passed the moment of sanction together, which was very difficult, very, very difficult. But I don't see the levels of constructive work together, I think, is diminishing.
You know, I would say you can argue it either way, but in the end, I think the collapse of Assad makes a nuclear deal more likely because the supreme leader will feel more isolated, under greater pressure, more likely to make tactical concessions in order to relieve further isolation and pressure. Of course, that's not going to change his fundamental interest in acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. I think it will confirm for him that, you know, the best way to defend himself against countries like the United States is to have that capacity. But at least in terms of near-term tactical, tactical decisions, I think the more he feels isolated and threatened, the more likely it is he'll make some modest concessions in order to have some kind of interim agreement.
Nikolsar from Khodnevis.org. How serious do you take the anti-missile fatwa of Ayatollah Khamenei? Is it real or a joke?
Anti-missile or anti-nuclear?
Anti-nuclear.
Anti-nuclear?
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't, you know much about, you know, Shia theology, but I think it certainly would provide a useful political basis on which the Supreme Leader and the Iranian government could justify some limits on the program And I think we would certainly, the P5 plus one, would certainly welcome, if the Iranians want to construct a theory for why they're accepting some limits on their nuclear program because it's consistent with the Supreme Leader's fatwa, then obviously that would be welcome. But whether it actually constrains activities, I doubt, because I think my impression anyway is that these fatwas can be changed pretty easily.
Thanks very much. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. I want to pose a question to both Ambassador Solano and Dr. Seymour, and beginning with an observation that Dr. Seymour made a few questions ago, in which I thought two very succinct observations were made. The first is that the interest of the Supreme Leader is not dignity per se, it's that he believes Iran should have the bomb. And the second is he sees the bomb question as only one piece of the frame in the relationship with the United States, which is that what we're really after is regime change. Given those two factors, if one accepts them, and for what it's worth, I do, what possible factors lie out there? Ambassador Solano said that the road to Tehran may run through Damascus. There is the presidential election. There is even the prospect of, at some point, Khamenei doesn't live forever. Knowing the two things that Dr. Seymour has stated, what is it that keeps us in the game, and why is it that President Obama continues to make statements that appear to be indefensible about that we will do whatever it takes to prevent Iran from having a bomb?
Well, let me take a crack at that. I mean, I think it's, what you said is exactly right. I also think it's true that the Supreme Leader wants to avoid going to war with the United States because he knows he'll lose, and that will probably lead or could lead to the end, of the Islamic Republic. So he's demonstrated over and over again caution in terms of limiting the nuclear program in order to avoid what he believes is a red line that could trigger a military attack. And I think the value in everything we've done in terms of public pressure, sanctions, threats of war, all of that has helped to reinforce his caution and has led to constraints, the Iranians could be moving forward much more quickly in terms of acquiring a nuclear weapons capacity if there were no constraints on the program. But they have imposed, self-imposed constraints in order to avoid those risks. So I think, whatever happens at the diplomatic table, we have an interest in continuing to make clear that we would not accept Iran having nuclear weapons and that we're prepared to use military force if necessary, and we're going to keep on increasing economic and political pressure. That has a positive impact.
The contradiction in which I think we are is the value of legitimacy of action is going high. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine after we have seen in Syria, et cetera, and after history, how a military action could be done without some legitimacy. Now, how is this legitimacy defined? We have been defined legitimacy lately by the Security Council. If we don't have the P5 together on action, it will be quite difficult to do it, and I would say quite difficult to have the international community in together. So it's not a trivial thing. It's not a trivial thing what we are talking about after the event of Libya, the event of Syria, and another. It will be very, very questionable if it is possible to be done without the Security Council resolution. And maintaining the international community, which in other issues can be governed together. So I think we have a lot of problems. And we have another problem we have not mentioned. Suppose that we get an agreement, and that agreement will have to imply lifting sanctions, and lifting sanctions rapidly. You have the Congress of the United States that has to do it. And that is not an easy task either, to leave sanctions. And that is known by the Supreme Leader also. So we have still some other problems that have to be considered, which made the problem really very delicate and very difficult.
Hi, Diane Barnes, Global Security Newswire. Dr. Seymour, you mentioned earlier both the possibilities that on the other side of the Iranian election in June, Iran will have greater flexibility for dialogue, as well as possibly lifting off the brakes it's been putting on production of 20% enriched uranium, as well as other sensitive activities. So I'm wondering whether you see an outcome of escalation or de-escalation being more likely, and what factors you see playing into that most. And I'd be interested in the ambassador's take as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I would say either is possible. I mean, one could imagine the Supreme Leader feeling more confident if he shores up his domestic situation, manages the presidential elections, makes sure that Ahmadinejad's candidate is not elected, and that he has somebody as president who he thinks is compliant and, you know, more competent in terms of managing the economy. And the Supreme Leader might then feel that he's in a stronger position to take the next step in the nuclear program, whatever that is, whether it's producing more 20% or announcing that, you know, Iran needs to produce higher levels of enrichment for their naval reactor program, for example. So one could imagine later this year there would be a confrontation. Or one could imagine that if he's in a stronger position, he's actually has, you know, greater flexibility to make some tactical deal with the P5+1 in order to relieve a pressure. And I don't know which way it will go, but I do think that as long as it's more likely to get a positive outcome if he believes that there's more sanctions to come. If the Supreme Leader believes that the P5+1 have reached the limit of what they're capable of doing, then I think it's more likely he will feel that he can weather the storm and doesn't need to make any concessions.
I tend to agree with that.
Thank you. Gaudat Bahagat from National Defense University. Two questions. The two sides claim time is on their side. What's your assessment? My second question, if we ever reach a deal with Iran, we have to sell it here in Washington, and given the relationship with Iran for the last 30 years, it would be very hard. I imagine the president will have to educate the public, the Congress. How do you think we can sell deal domestically here? Thank you.
I think you have to sell any agreement on its merits. I mean, if the agreement actually achieves the intended result, which is to limit Iran's ability to produce nuclear weapons, then I think you have a very strong basis on which to convince Congress and the public that it's worth supporting. If the deal really doesn't have a dramatic impact, if it's just cosmetic and it allows the Iranians to continue on their course of expanding the capacity to produce fissile material, then I think the deal won't be supported. But, of course, we have to keep in mind that any agreement that is reached will be subject to very, you know, strict monitoring. I mean, Iran has demonstrated that it doesn't, that it's not shy about cheating on its international obligations, and it has a long, very long record of, you know, violating the NPT and safeguards and agreements it's reached with other parties. So one could imagine a situation where there was some kind of an agreement and some ways down the road it was revealed that Iran was violating that.
They would have to convince also other parties. Saudi Arabia, for instance, has to be convinced that the agreement is okay, and is and others. You understand what I mean.
Back. Dan Campos, George Washington University. Can you expand on the nuclear collaboration between Iran and Russia, and are they legal under the NPT?
Well, yes. The cooperation between Russia and Iran is legal, not under the non-proliferative treaty. We accepted, the P5 accepted that the enrichment of the uranium was placed in the Bushehr nuclear reactor, but the subproducts of that produced in the reactor were taken by Russia. That was you remember that Russia was very cautious in moving the construction of the Bushehr reactor, and then it was accepted and even encouraged to finish and to encourage to put the fuel in it. So I think, yes, in my mind, yes.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing I would add is that there have been some instances where Russian scientists or institutes have provided unauthorized nuclear assistance to Iran. And, you know, President Bush, for example, confronted President Putin with the fact that Russian institutes were helping with the heavy water research reactor that's being built in Iraq. And the Russian government stopped that. So I think there's a pretty good record of the Russian government limiting nuclear cooperation with Iran to the Bushehr reactor, you know, which is something we've accepted.
Hi, my name is Saba Ahmed, and I'm a law student at American University. I had a question about why the military strike is even on the table, because haven't we learned our lessons from Iraq? We've killed so many people, we've hurt our military, we've drowned our economy. Why would we even consider doing that with Iran? Why, as an American business owner, why can't I buy oil from Iran? Why is that such, the oil prices were like at 99 cents a gallon in 2001, and now they're at like 4 something. If we go to war with Iran, it will probably be $8 a gallon or something like that. Why are we hurting our own American economic interests to prevent somebody from pursuing their national defense strategies like any other country does?
Well, I see it as a clash of interest. I mean, the Iranians, for reasons that are perfectly understandable from their standpoint, think having nuclear weapons or the capacity to produce nuclear weapons is necessary for their defense and to assert their position in the region. The U.S., for reasons that are perfectly understandable from our standpoint, we want to stop Iran from having nuclear weapons because it would be a threat to our interests and to the interests of our friends in the region. So there's just a clash of interest. I'm not saying anybody's right and anybody's wrong, but usually in international politics, if you have a clash of interests and you can't reconcile them, then the ultimate recourse is the use of force. I mean, clearly, President Obama is not looking for opportunities to attack Iran. He obviously has made the case that we're not at that point where we have to make that choice, that there's still room for diplomacy, room for sanctions and pressure, still some possibility that will achieve results. But at the end of the day, he's saying that the matter is so important to the United States that he'd be willing to use force if necessary. I mean, people may disagree with that judgment, but that's the judgment that he's made and explained publicly.
Alvin Keyswitter with Denton's. My question is largely for Gary. Do you think the U.S. is prepared to acknowledge Iran's right to enrich at some level, say 5% at some point?
I mean, I think if you had an agreement that satisfied our goal of limiting Iran's capacity, its ability to produce nuclear weapons, I think some limited enrichment, and this is obviously my view, some limited enrichment as part of satisfying Iran's dignity, as part of some face-saving outcome, should be acceptable to us. But I don't see any evidence that Iran is prepared to accept the kind of limited enrichment that we would really require in order to you know, in order to achieve the results of physically limiting what they're capable of doing.
If allow me to say, I don't think it's imaginable in agreement with have recognition of something of enrichment by Iran. That's the trick, is how that is worked. But I think I cannot imagine, after having spent hours and hours and hours with them, they can accept anything that takes the program to be disassembled. This is,
I mean, one of the complications in this negotiation is that the Iranians are insisting that their so-called right to enrichment be recognized by the P5+1, and yet at the same time, the Iranians are not prepared to acknowledge that they have obligations imposed on them by the UN Security Council and the IAEA to take certain actions to demonstrate that their program is peaceful. So it's hard to imagine a deal where, you know, we accept their principle and they don't accept ours. I mean, if you had a mutual acceptance where, you know, we were prepared to acknowledge that once confidence is restored, they could pursue a civil program like any other NPT party, including enrichment. But one would expect in return that they would acknowledge that they are obligated by the UN Security Council to take certain actions, which includes a suspension of their enrichment program until confidence is restored.
Abdul Majid Sigali from City University of New York. I'm from Kurdistan region, Iraq. And my question is about the negotiations and the details. Was there other topics other than the nuclear program with Iran talked about, like Iran's destabilizer role in the Middle East in supporting terrorist groups in Iraq, in Lebanon? Was there and other issues internally for Iran, like its horrible human rights violations and democracy?
Well, in the negotiations, it was first a negotiation on Iran, and then the possibility we get engaged in an honest negotiation with them. There are many other topics that we would like to talk to them. Remember that Iran was at the table in the Bonn agreements on Afghanistan. In those negotiations, Iran was on the table. We at a given moment, the Bush administration was thinking about putting on the Afghanistan now, in the second phase Afghanistan negotiation also in the regional, but nothing without having created the climate appropriate to on the nuclear issue, appropriate to enter into other potential topics of discussion.
You know, the P5+1 talks were created for the purpose of addressing the nuclear issue, so that's tended to be the primary focus, certainly in terms of what the P5+1 would like the agenda to focus on. It's true that the Iranians have periodically said, well, we want to have a much broader discussion. We want to talk about Syria. We want to talk about Bahrain. And that's generally been resisted by the P5+1, in part because we don't want to create anxiety on the parts of other countries in the region that we're negotiating some kind of, you know, regional arrangements with the Iranians when they're not present at the table to have their interests represented.
Okay, we've got about 5 minutes left, and we've got way more hands, so I'm going to take three questions, and then we'll give you the chance to answer those that you want.
Well, as we approach Andrew Pierre, as we approach the end, let me say this has been a very, very interesting discussion. I'd like to move for a second to sort of the framework of perceptions. The president's statements, Gary, I think has led to a perception that this year or next year are really critical years, that if we don't, quote, solve somehow the, quote, unquote, the nuclear issue in Iran, that we will be moving inexorably towards a war, conflict. And we seem to be, you know, discussing this with the Israelis, although in the last meeting, Netanyahu sort of walked back a little bit from the red line he painted at the UN. On the other hand, as I think this discussion very well brought out, the weaponization has a long ways to go. And true weaponization might not at all occur in the presidency of President Obama. So are we running a risk here of perhaps being a bit too smart by half, in that we're sort of creating a perception of imminent danger and conflict and decisions about that, whereas in fact weaponization is not progressing as far as we know, and if it did, it would take some time. We're really talking about something beyond the next 3 years.
Okay. Up here. All right. In the second row here.
My name is Hassan. I was born in Tehran. I present Global Bridges for Humanity. It seems to me that for many years, America has been engaged in persuading Iran to come in line, the line that America thinks is the right for Iran. And we have, up to this point, seen that, as they say, it's very hard not to crack, so Iranians are not that easy to be pushed over. And as Mr. Solano knows, when the Turkish proposal was done for the 20%, and they agreed about all of that, but the fine line was this, that you give us the 20%, and we'll tell you when it's ready, then you can get it back. So that was not acceptable to them. So it's not a very, when you're negotiating, you have to have some kind of a principle to follow. So we're coming to a point that to recognize that Iran may be a regional power. Why don't we get Iran and see what our interests are in that area, see if Iran can protect our interests in that area. They're capable and they don't cost us anything. They'd be more than happy to do and protect our interests without any money to give them like we do to other people in that area. And the question is this, that after all these discussions, when it goes beyond a certain point, it shows the impotence of America in solving a problem that is very important to the world.
Okay. And then last question, one hand, okay, over here.
Laura Rosen from Al Monitor. Gary and Ambassador Solano, is there any price that you think that the P5+1 would be willing to pay that Iran could accept for the 20% for a small deal? And if not, in some reasonable amount of time, I'm particularly interested in, Gary, if what you think about the kind of Dennis Ross go big idea or offering them a more comprehensive offer. Thanks.
Okay, let me take those. You know, on the timetable, as I've tried to explain, I think the timetable is determined by political decisions and calculations, not by physics. If the Supreme Leader does things that brings this matter to a head this year, and there are lots of things he could do that could force President Obama's hand, then, in fact, we may be facing a military conflict in the near future. On the other hand, the Supreme Leader may deliberately avoid actions that would force the United States to act, in which case the diplomacy, the sanctions, the nuclear creeping, all of this will continue for years. So I think it really remains to be seen whether or not the next year or two is critical or whether this problem will continue pretty much along its current pattern for the next couple of years, for the rest of President Obama's term. On the question of other issues in the region, I mean, the truth is, the U.S. and Iran are at loggerheads on almost every issue, whether it's Syria, and I agree with Mr. Solana that this really has cast a shadow over all of the negotiations. But whether it's peace process, Hezbollah, U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf, I mean, on almost every issue, the U.S. and Iran are really, enemies. And that obviously makes it much more difficult to deal with the nuclear issue in isolation. And finally, Laura, I think that it is possible that Iran could decide after the presidential elections to accept the small deal that's on the table now. In fact, I think it's a pretty good deal from Iran's standpoint. If they're looking for a way to create some respite from pressure and sanctions, what's on offer would do that. It might not lead to a comprehensive deal, but at least it would slow down the sanctions train. The trouble with putting forward a big idea is that I think it's virtually guaranteed to fail, because anything we would accept in terms of end state, in terms of what their nuclear program would look like, I just think is fundamentally unacceptable to the Iranians, because it would take away their nuclear weapons capability, and that's the whole purpose of the program.
Let me comment on the three questions and a final reflection. I think the first thing I would like to say is that the level of mistrust between the United States or the Western world and Iran is really very difficult to convey. You cannot imagine the level of mistrust. The war Iraq-Iran had not been forgotten in Iran. And we were playing the role of Iraq at the time. And still that is really on this. In the negotiator, the second negotiator had a leg lost when he was 14 years of age in the war Iraq-Iran. So this is really, keep in mind, this is a very tricky, very difficult situation still to recuperate the trust. Number one. Number two, in the most candid moment in the negotiation that they had, in the moment we just walking and with no interpreters because they speak English, although they don't want to speak it. If I ask, well, what would be your dream? Could you tell me what it would be, what you wanted to obtain, really? I take it as not the complete answer, but a very important direction of what they want. We look very much to Brazil. Why do you look to Brazil so much? Brazil is a regional power. Brazil has a nuclear reactor which is nuclear. But they have not produced anything. They have been allowed to have a certain capability, which is not that they have not been used, etc. But they have that. They want to be a regional power recognized. And in order to be a regional power recognized, they need to have some level of... you look at the world. You have Japan, you have Brazil, you have Argentina, and I want not to stop because there are some others which are with some capabilities. No? So why we not? Well, this is the question that why do you not allow us to go that far? And the answer has been given great. We don't trust the situation. But Brazil was always in the... not always, but when we talk candidly, Brazil was a good model for them. I don't know if it answered you, but this is regional power with the recognition that they were class A. The class A means you are at the level of capabilities in nuclear activity.
Brazil was part of the Atlantic Declaration. That's why Iran was the second one that they did.
Okay.
I don't have anything else to add. It's going to be very difficult, but I think it's doable. That is what I really think.
Okay. With apologies to those who I could not get to their questions, please join me in thanking our speakers.
That was really good.